Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, economic fallout from the coronavirus pandemic could prove devastating to the Philadelphia School District. We'll hear from Superintendent William Height in just a bit. Also, it was an NFL draft like none other. The Philadelphia Inquirer's Marcus Hayes will tell us about this weekend's virtual event and how the Eagles fared. But first, after weeks of coronavirus restrictions, it's possible Pennsylvania will slowly begin to come to life May 8th. Governor Wolf is looking to reopen portions of the state at that time. But even so, there will be constraints. Social distancing rules will remain in effect. Not all businesses in targeted areas will be allowed to resume operations at first. And reopening will depend to a great extent on extensive testing to determine the concentration of the virus in various areas and counties. There's a lot to unpack with the rollout, and here to help us do that is WHYY's Katie Meyer. Welcome back, Katie.
Thank you.
So we're talking about a light at the end of the tunnel, but, frankly, right now the light might be flickering just a bit. I just read over the weekend that the number of cases is still on the rise in Pennsylvania. And Katie, there are also, a lot of what-ifs to Governor Wolf's plan. Let's start with the color-coded tier system. Right now, the entire state is in what's called the red phase, correct?
Yes, it is. And so that basically means there's a statewide stay-at-home order. Pretty much all businesses that are deemed non-life-sustaining are supposed to be closed unless they have a waiver from the state. So that's kind of the full lockdown situation.
And yellow is next?
Yellow is next, ideally. And so that one kind of comes with Wolf's most specific criteria. He gave some numbers for it. And basically, the hope is that a region or a county can start reopening if they have an average of fewer than 50 coronavirus cases for every 100,000 residents over the course of 14 days. So I should say that decision is going to be really subjective, according to the governor. So for instance, even if a county has a pretty low case count, meets that criteria, say they're next to another county that has a really bad outbreak, their reopening could be delayed because, a virus does not typically respect county lines. So even if a county does get a yellow designation, and there are a couple that look like they might be in line to do that starting May 8th, which is when this would begin to roll out, the yellow designation would mean, businesses with in-person operations can start reopening. The stay-at-home order would officially end in those counties, although, there's still restrictions in place. Everyone's supposed to wear masks, practice social distancing. People who are elderly or immunocompromised should still stay home. And, gatherings would still be restricted.
And noteworthy, some businesses might be excluded from opening under the yellow regardless.
They would under the governor's plan, yes. So places like, gyms and spas where there's a lot of close quarters, the virus, experts say it can travel more easily indoors. So places like that would still be closed. Theaters, casinos, entertainment venues like that would still be closed. Schools would not have in-person instruction still. So sure. It would be, again, a limited reopening.
But would the yellow phase change anything for the state's hard-hit restaurant industry? I think over 330,000 are laid off.
Yeah. There still wouldn't be dine-in service under the yellow phase. It would still be just carry-out and delivery. So, it wouldn't change a whole lot for them.
And regarding areas of Pennsylvania, Katie, which might be more likely to enter the yellow phase first, Philly, unfortunately, the Philly area it doesn't seem to be even close.
No, it doesn't. I mean, Philly is the hardest hit area of the state, Philadelphia and the surrounding, more suburban counties. So we are looking at a longer lockdown for Philly. And again, it's hard to say exactly how long it will be. But, for context, let me pull up the numbers here. On Friday, this was the latest numbers on Friday, Philadelphia's cases to date were 12,329. And that's not just new cases, that's all of them. But you get a sense, cases are still going up. It looks like it might be leveling off a little bit, but we're not close to reaching that, 50 cases per 100,000 people threshold.
And when you were talking a little bit earlier about counties which might be adjoining each other and one perhaps being getting ready to enter into the yellow phase but being hindered because its next door neighbor might not be close, really we're also talking about the Philadelphia region, Montgomery, Bucks, Delaware counties, you know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, and remember at the beginning of this, you know, Montgomery County was the hardest hit at first. All of the counties around Philadelphia were sort of the epicenter of the outbreak. And, you know, Philadelphia's cases have obviously risen faster, but sure, they are still, you know, they're not looking at a reopening very soon.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. So
we will.
So, you know, following the yellow phase, if an area does well, then, if, you know, and cases continue to drop, then they possibly enter the green phase. Does that mean we're free and clear and life resumes as normal?
Well, more or less. I mean, there are a couple caveats. You know, people would still be encouraged to take safety precautions, like, you know, wearing masks, these things the CDC and the State Health Department have recommended, you know, making sure you're washing your hands, using hand sanitizer, that kind of thing. And also, we should note, you know, even if you get to the green phase, say, if there's a spike in cases and it's bad enough, you know, the governor has kind of said there's no guarantee that you're going to stay in the green phase. If things get bad again, we're going to reimpose these, you know, social distancing guidelines, business closure guidelines. So it's not, these aren't hard and fast rules. And I think the tough part is, like, there's going to be a lot of subjective decisions here. And so it's difficult to say, oh, if you do, you know, A, B, and C, you're free and clear. You're in the green phase. It's just, you know, yeah. I think pandemic responses have to be a little, you know, squishier than that.
So suffice it to say, there could be some toggling back and forth between phases in various areas of the state. And again,
there could be.
We're looking at, you know, May 8th, perhaps some areas going into the yellow phase. It really more in the north central and northwestern part of the state.
Yes, exactly. And those are, you know, states or areas of the state that are, you know, less dense, they're more rural. They've had a pretty low case count overall. But we should note they also don't have a lot of hospital capacity. So if there were to be a spike in one of those areas, it would be even more devastating. So that's something, you know, we also have to take into account.
All right, we are talking with WHYY's Katie Meyer. She reports on politics and other stories for us here at WHYY. Katie, how will testing for the spread of the coronavirus play in Pennsylvania's attempts to reopen? Who needs to be involved? Is there a system in place to do it?
So, I mean, there is a system. A lot of this is sort of like ideal scenarios. So one of, you know, the governor, among his other criteria for moving a county into the yellow phase, says there has to be enough testing available specifically for people with symptoms and people who are high risk, healthcare personnel, first responders, you know, quote unquote target populations like that. There also has to be case investigation, contact tracing. Now, the latter two things, so case investigation, contact tracing, that's starting, but like on a pretty limited basis, especially in like places where cases are high, like Philly. And then as far as testing goes, you know, ideally, yes, we do have robust testing in order to guarantee that we're safe to go back, you know, to work, to school. However, it's been really hard for the state to get enough tests. We're pretty much relying on the federal government for that stuff right now. And all states, pretty much, not just Pennsylvania, have struggled to get the equipment and the supplies that they need to do these tests. So our testing capacity has increased in Pennsylvania. You know, the state's partnering with Carnegie Mellon to make a data dashboard of, you know, testing capacity, other spread data. But we're not where I think state officials would like to be in terms of testing.
All right. Also, Katie, state officials are revising the way they're counting COVID deaths. Why are they doing this?
Mm. So that was a move that was taken late last week. It was kind of confusing at first because we saw the death count suddenly go down and we're like, well, that can't be correct. But it was because they had changed the way it was counted. Basically, cases where they weren't sure if someone had died, but they thought they had died of COVID, those cases, those assumed cases have not been counted anymore. So they've been taken out of the count. And that was the probable cases. That was just a way for the state to try to make the counts a little bit more accurate, they said. You know, there was a lot of, some people were upset about this. They said, oh, you know, the state was inflating the numbers. I think it really is genuinely like just a change in tactics.
Sure. Sure. And also this note for our New Jersey listeners, New Jersey Governor Murphy today is expected to release early details of a plan to begin reopening the Garden State. And that could be based on Pennsylvania Governor Wolf's color coded strategy. So we will keep you up to speed on that. Katie, you know, as always, there's a very human aspect to this story. You reported on a South Philadelphia Garden Center, which received a waiver to stay open, but is struggling nonetheless. The Urban Jungle.
Yes, the Urban Jungle. And actually, so I should say, the reason I was even looking into garden centers was this has been sort of a pet area of anger or frustration among Republicans. They, other states that surround Pennsylvania classified garden centers because they often sell and grow food plants. They classified them as essential businesses, let them stay open. Pennsylvania didn't. And so Urban Jungle, I talked to them. They actually had a waiver to keep operating. And Curtis Alexander is one of the owners who I spoke to. And he said, you know, even though they're still operating, they're doing like curbside pickup. He's lost like 90% of his business. So he was, you know, things have been really tough for them. And they are, again, still operating. So even if businesses do go back into operation on a limited basis, even on a full-time basis, we have to remember that this was still a really damaging experience for a lot of them. You know, people just are not out shopping, nor should they be. And so I think it's important to remember that, you know, reopening is not going to be, you know, a fix-all strategy here.
Yeah. And I think, as you noted, Mr. Alexander is hoping for some desperately needed help from the federal government here to stay afloat.
Yes. Yes. From the Federal Paycheck Protection Program. And I've talked to a bunch of business owners who are really hoping they get money from, you know, the PPP. And some have. Curtis Alexander specifically said, you know, he did all his paperwork. He wasn't able to get through because the program essentially ran out of money during their first iteration of trying to give people relief. And so, you know, I've talked to people who have gotten the money and they say it's still kind of difficult to like use it for all the things they need to because it's pretty limited. It's time limited, you know, how long you can use it for. So I think everybody's really doing a lot of trial and error right now to figure out how to keep themselves, if not whole, then like just still existing when things eventually maybe do go back to normal. So, yeah, the garden centers were one category of business that I focused on last week. But there's, you know, a lot of businesses are in very similar boats.
And, well, worth noting on a positive note, I guess, that there's encouraging news for both the construction and car sales industries. They might up and running a little bit before the May 8th date.
Yes, that's right. So those two, I mentioned that garden centers were sort of a pet project for a lot of Republicans trying to get them reopened. Construction and car sales were the first two for them. And car sales, it was a similar argument to, well, both of them, they were all similar arguments that other states that surround us had allowed construction, had allowed car sales to continue in a remote capacity, and that Pennsylvania's rules were more restrictive, which was the case. And so Governor Wolf announced last week that construction could resume on May 1st. And I've heard from some construction workers wondering, like, why that decision was made. Wolf said that it was because construction workers often do work in sort of socially distanced atmospheres anyway.
All right, Katie, I'm going to have to stop you there, unfortunately. Great conversation. We'll catch up again soon, I'm sure. That's WHYY's Katie Meyer, sure. Coming up next, Philadelphia School Superintendent William Height. The school system could see a huge budget deficit because of COVID-19. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The Philadelphia School District is grappling with some grim news. It's estimated the coronavirus pandemic could cost the district hundreds of millions of dollars, leaving it as much as $1 billion in the red in just 5 years. Suffice it to say, this financial forecast is disheartening, to say the least, for an urban school district which spent many painful years climbing out of a hole created by the Great Recession. Last week, Philadelphia School Superintendent William Height said this, quote, has the potential to erase all of the progress we've made over the last 8 years, particularly financially. So what does this mean to Philadelphia's public school students, many of whom live in poverty, their teachers, and aging school buildings in dire need of repair? For questions or comments, send them to Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can email us or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Superintendent William Height joins us once again for Radio Times. And glad to have you with us, Superintendent Height. But boy, we wish the circumstances were a little more encouraging.
So do we, Mary. And as you indicated, first of all, good morning and thank you for having me. And as you indicated, we have made progress the last 5 years as it relates to finance and progress. We do not want to go backwards. I'm sure people recall the scenarios that we had to struggle through after the recession and back in 2012, 2013, when we had lots of resources taken out of schools, lots of positions that schools had to do without, positions like counselors and music and art teachers. And we've been able to restore many of those things. And we are worried that this could take us back to those days. And we don't want to return to those days. And you, even as you think of some of the environmental challenges that we've had to face and that we're trying to resolve, all of those things were a product of us eliminating really important services and positions from the school district just to make ends meet back in 2012, 2013. We kind of come out of that, but now we are now facing, because of COVID-19, the same type, could be facing the same type of predicament moving forward.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, William Height, but is, you know, calamitous too strong a word to describe the potential situation?
No, it is not. I mean, and one of the things that I think is distinctive here is that we're still in front of this. The last time when I arrived in 2012, we were already in the experience. And now the distinction, though, is that every school district in the country is going through this.
Yeah.
And I do think that we have to think of ways now to advocate both at the state and federal levels to be in front of what could happen if we don't address this issue.
Before we get into how this might affect the kids directly, let's walk through some of the nuts and bolts of the financial piece of the story. For the moment, from what I've read, the district is okay for the moment. There are reserve funds to help cover an immediate hit of $64 million, which would have come from some local revenue, local taxes.
That's correct. And one of the just the nuts and bolts, Mary, many of our resources come from a series of local taxes. All of those have been impacted by the stay-at-home order in the shelter in place and social distancing. And so some $60 million will be lost for this current school year. At the same time, we're also expending monies to get children technology, to get cleaning supplies, to sanitize all schools, and to pay individuals to come in as they are deemed essential, and to work around the clock in some cases to distribute meals, technology, and to address some of the environmental issues. So that we can absorb that with a fund balance. It's one reason why you have fund balances in large organizations like ours. We could absorb that with our current fund balance. Mm. Even after that, though, we have a $38 million projected shortfall for the next year. And as you indicated, that balloons to over $1 billion in FY25 at the current levels of spending and at the current levels of expected revenues from the state and from the city.
So let's talk about the city. Mayor Kenney has made education a priority of his administration. But, you know, we could see cuts of 20%. In the city budget. Mr. Kenney will present his revised budget Friday. Any early word as to how the school district might be affected? Have you heard from the mayor?
Now, the mayor has been extremely supportive, as has city council, with providing us with the revenue to maintain our balance and to protect the investments that we have made. It has been no word about what the cuts could be to the school district, but knowing Mayor Kenney and how important public education is to him, the last thing, and these are my words, not his, that I think he wants to do is to put us at peril in terms of our funding situation. So he will do everything within his power and authority, I'm sure, to keep the school district as much as possible whole. As I indicated earlier, everyone remembers what we had to experience back in 2012, 2013, and we don't want to return to that set of scenarios.
The Philadelphia School District also depends on a lot of funding from the state. And William Height, there are estimates that the state of Pennsylvania itself could be grappling with a budget deficit of over $3.5 billion due to the pandemic. Any early indication from the Wolf administration as to how this might impact the district?
Yeah, so we are anticipating under the maintenance of effort rules or law that the state could reduce our revenues some portion. We've actually built that into our projections, which could mean some significant losses, at least from the state's perspective. We're talking about two things that we feel like need to happen in order to offset that. One is to ensure that all of the monies that are coming for the purpose of stabilizing public education, those monies are pushed through to the school districts, and they're not used to hopefully offset the state's deficit. That's number one. Number two is we are just asking the state, if at all possible, to maintain the current levels of spending. And if that's possible, at least as relates to public education, it could help us offset some significant revenue shortfalls that we have. So one is to pass all of the stimulus money from the CARES Act that is designated for education to the public schools. And the second is to maintain the current levels of funding. That's this year's level of funding, not what was proposed, but if they could just maintain the 1920 year funding levels, that would be helpful.
Do you anticipate this taking some rather ferocious advocacy on your part and on the part of people like Joyce Wilkerson, president of the Board of Education, to achieve those goals you just outlined?
Absolutely. And we have fortunately had advocacy already from the Chamber of Commerce recommending something very similar, from our colleagues at City Council, from our colleagues from around the Commonwealth and other school districts. But it will also require our local advocacy community to also be advocating on that, on our behalf as it relates to that. As you know, Mary, the district has no ability to raise its own revenues. And so unlike many of the surrounding districts, we cannot then impose new taxes or generate revenue. All of our revenue comes from the local tax sources and the state. And any cuts to those would then impact us pretty dramatically.
Our guest is William Height, superintendent of the School District of Philadelphia. There are union negotiations looming or even underway with the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers and the Blue Collar Workers Union. What do you expect you might need to ask of organized labor?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's all something that we're going to be navigating through, and they also understand the precarious position that we're in. And we're asking those labor partners to also advocate with us on behalf. And none of these numbers, Mary, that we talked about on your show thus far include new labor contracts, right? So that none of these include new labor contracts. And so the situation would even be exacerbated if, in fact, we talk about additional spending as it relates to labor. So it will take all of our collective advocacy around some things that can be done now so that we don't have to go backwards. And we are in negotiations. We have opened negotiations both with the PFT and with our 32BJ SEIU, and those negotiations are ongoing. But by the same token, this was not as anticipated or expected And now we have to deal with the consequences as it relates to this. And so these are new considerations that become a part of that, those negotiations. And those are two unions that have worked with us in the past. And we hope that they will both be advocates on behalf of additional revenue, as I know they will, but they will also work to help us problem solve through this precarious financial position.
Worst case scenario, if there is, say, at the end of 5 years, a $1 billion deficit, do you see layoffs? Do you see school buildings closing?
Well, we have started some mitigation steps already, and we have now instituted a central office hiring freeze, and our central office is still smaller than most around the country because of the cuts that we took in 2012-2013. We're also carefully monitoring the school budget hiring trends, and we're having ongoing evaluations of all of the obligated funds and the central office budgets for the remainder of this year. We are also reviewing the past expenditure reduction decisions for lessons learned regarding the relative impact of cuts. And the reason that's critically important is because the last time we went through this, what we were trying to do was keep the cuts away from the classrooms as much as possible. But now we know from experience that all of those cuts, depending on the cuts and the people and the staff that were cut and the resources, then they ultimately do have a pretty significant impact on the classroom. Sure. So when you lay off all of your maintenance staff, you are likely to have challenges with the facilities. When you release all of the counselors, then children are challenged as they try to navigate college acceptances and social and emotional issues. When you don't have nurses in schools, that creates other problems. And so we've learned from those lessons in the past. We're also reviewing all proposed new investment spendings to determine what can be delayed. And we're reviewing and prioritizing all of our contracts that were coming up this spring. And so the current mitigation steps underway, but to put in perspective, a $38 million loss would represent about 1% of our budget. And there are certain costs that are fixed costs like charter schools, debt service. And once you deal with those, then it represents about 2% of our budget, and you cannot make those reductions without cutting people. And we hope we don't have to get to that point.
Last resort. That's what it sounds like.
It would be an absolute last resort.
So let's talk about the children. Chromebooks have been handed out. New learning should begin online May 4th. Is that the correct date?
That's correct. That's May 4th, and we have now distributed some 80,000 Chromebooks, Mary, and I want to do a huge shout-out to our IT department, many of the teachers who have been working diligently to connect with students before the Chromebooks were delivered. We're going into week two of teacher-led enrichment and review. And many of our teachers now have office hours. They're connecting with the children in their classrooms. And we will begin what we'll call planned instruction. And the planned instruction will begin May 4th, Monday. That's when we will then take attendance. And attendance is more from participation. Children would be expected to be logging in and completing assignments.
A new term I just saw this morning, the COVID-19 slide. There's concern about that regarding education. You know, the pandemic, of course, have forced the physical closure of schools, I think, since mid-March. So we're talking nearly 2 months of learning that in some way, shape, or form has been disrupted. Are the kids going to be able to make up what's been lost in order to move to the next grade or to graduate on time, William Height?
They're going to be able to graduate on time. I do think that when you lose this amount of time in a school year, and I think that's regardless of where we're talking about, whether it's the School District of Philadelphia or any other urban district around the country, there are going to naturally be some losses to the skills and the learning that children have experienced or students would have experienced if the year was a normal year. And so we can anticipate, and this will be more impactful for children who were already behind with respect to the reading levels or the math levels. I worry about children with special needs or children who are English language learners. This will ultimately impact those young people, and we will have to come up with strategies to make sure that whenever we return to some form of normalcy, those are the first populations that we are addressing. I would be representing something that is inaccurate if I said it would be absolutely no learning loss after we have missed 2 months of with teacher to student instruction. And while we are doing digital learning, nothing digitally replaces the daily interaction of a teacher and a student.
Of course. So is there an extension of the school year perhaps in the offing, or summer school to help make up some of the feared slide?
Yeah, so we're not doing an extension. We will be closing. Our school year ends on June 12th, and we are going to continue with that calendar date. However, what we do in the summer, though, will be based on, and whether it is digital or in person, we're going to have to focus our original efforts on those populations that I described, and that our efforts will have to be more directed not to the whole community, but the children who are most in need of either additional support, additional learning time. And then we're thinking about how do we begin next year in order to do, number one, some sort of assessment to determine where all children are, and then build from that point moving forward.
And I've only got about 20 seconds here, but next year, the fall, I'm assuming plans are at least in the early stages as to whether, you know, online, in class, I mean, everything's up in the air.
Everything's up in the air, and we're planning for multiple strategies, Mary, and having a lot of different approaches, and we want to make sure that we keep all options open, because this could be digital, it could be in person, or hybrid, some hybrid of both.
All right, Superintendent of the Philadelphia School District, William Height, as always, a pleasure.
Pleasure's all mine.
Thank you. And sports columnist Marcus Hayes is up next. We're going to talk about how the Eagles fared in the first virtual NFL draft. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Sports fans were finally treated to a live event this weekend, the NFL Draft, held as a virtual broadcast for the first time ever. It did not disappoint in drama, spectacle, and ratings. Millions tuned in. The Eagles made at least one mind-boggling move with the second-round selection of former Alabama quarterback Jalen Hurts, which, of course, raises a host of questions about the future of franchise quarterback Carson Wentz. And there's much more so. Did the Eagles get what they wanted and needed? And if you watched the draft, what did you think of the retooled version? Here's the email address, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Marcus Hayes, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, is back with us once again. Hi, Marcus.
Hello, Mary. How are you quarantining?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
Well, I have three little girls, so every day is pretty active and kind of an adventure for us. So it's going breezingly for the parents anyway. We're certainly occupied.
Well, good to hear. So the first NFL, virtual NFL draft was, all right, so what are some objectives? Fun, a little goofy at times, exciting, successful? What's your take, Marcus?
I thought it was a spectacular success. I mean, I've never been a huge fan of Roger Goodell, the commissioner, and I don't think that he is particularly warm and fuzzy and human, but he will never be more human than he was in his blazer or his sweater or I think he had a T-shirt on Saturday.
At one point, yeah.
Something like that. Sitting in his, you know, in his really kind of like retro 70s, finished basement. You expected to see like a shuffleboard table over in a corner. and you know, that kind of ugly brown recliner. You know, he was kind of the star of the show. He was like, he was really, really good at it, and he was genuine. He was authentic. He wasn't, you know, as corny and as awkward and as, you know, fake cool as he tries to be, you know, at, you know, either when it was at Radio City Music Hall or since 2015 when it's been kind of a traveling road show. That's not who he is. I mean, he's a member of Augusta National. That's who he is. He's an awkward, weird guy, and he was awkward and weird, but familiar and human. I thought the production was really, really good. You know, it was, they made the best, I think, they could of it.
I love the virtual hugs he would give the guys. Him trying to hug, you know, virtually a huge linebacker.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It was so corny and so dorky that you knew it was genuine, because that's who Roger Goodell is. He's just a, you know, he's the kind of nice uncle that you see at Thanksgiving every year, but no, don't need to see more than once a year. You know what I'm saying?
And at the same time, there was some controversy over whether the draft should be held in the first place, because it's such a tough time, you know, in our nation's history. But none other than Dr. Anthony Fauci endorsed holding it. And Marcus, we do need some distraction, don't we?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a business. It's a non-essential business, but it's the part of the business that doesn't hurt anybody. I didn't understand the consternation, especially considering, you know, a month earlier we'd had this free agency period where young men were being given hundreds of millions of dollars by billionaires. So I thought the draft is relatively benign by comparison. I understand unemployment has skyrocketed since free agency, but we knew this was coming when free agency took place. I didn't really see it as, you know, improper or untoward at all.
Well, let's get to the biggest news for Eagles fans, I think anyway, and a shocker for many, the selection of former Alabama quarterback Jalen Hurts. Were you expecting something like this?
I expected them to take a quarterback and groom him for the future. I didn't realize that they considered the position, number one, as urgent, as important as they do. And I didn't realize they thought Jalen Hurts is as good as they think he is. Jalen Hurts is a 3-year starter at the absolute elite level. He's a plug-and-play player. If you think Jalen Hurts can play, he's a plug-and-play player. He's the kind of guy who can come in and help your team right away. He accounted for 53 touchdowns last season at Oklahoma and was the runner-up for the Heisman Trophy. He's a really, really good player. He's a really talented player. He's not, you know, Joe Burrow, the LSU quarterback who won the Heisman and went number one overall, sure, and should have. But he's a very, very good player. And I always saw him as a pretty good quarterback with the capacity to be a very good quarterback. And, I mean, I understand that the perception is that the Eagles have a lot of needs. But, you know, unless they're going to pick a linebacker there, they really don't have a lot of needs. They have a lot of players they think can play this season at least, including wide receivers. And they took a wide receiver, Jalen Reagor, a fast wide receiver, in the first round. So taking Jalen Hurts and essentially anointing him as your backup, to me, makes a lot more sense than most people seem to want to let it make.
Well, that
you need two quarterbacks.
Well, that was the next question.
Carson Wentz has missed 25% of his snaps in the last 3 years.
Yeah. Well, So then Nate Sudfeld, who is the backup, falls to number three, in your opinion?
You know, they only signed him for $1 million, and there was no market for Nate Sudfeld as a backup quarterback in this free agency period. So I never thought $4 million that Nate Sudfeld was a viable number two. Now, he's going to have to be the number two, and this gets kind of granular here, assuming there is no real offseason and Jalen Hurts can't be coached the way he would normally be coached. Nate Sudfeld, in his third season in the system, will have to be the backup quarterback entering the season, unless Jalen Hurts is just, you know, savant brilliant and really, you know, fits the system wonderfully. And they'll have to activate three quarterbacks. Most teams only activate two quarterbacks every week. But Jalen Hurts is going to be active. And Nate Sudfeld will probably have to be active too, because at least until Jalen Hurts can digest and synthesize and perform at least a part of the playbook. So, you know, I'd be surprised to see Jalen Hurts as the number two before late October.
Okay. Well, one quick question before we move on from this topic. There were some who saw the selection of Jalen Hurts as a question about the faith the organization has in a franchise quarterback, Carson Wentz, who, must be noted, somehow got the Birds to the playoffs last year, a very hurt team. That's what I'm trying to get at here. Winning the last four straight until Wentz was knocked out by Jadeveon Clowney in his very first playoff game. Is there a lack of faith in Carson Wentz, or is, you know, the selection of Jalen Hurts just made sense?
I think whether or not you think Carson Wentz will stay healthy, I don't think there's a lack of faith in Carson Wentz's capacity to perform. I think there's a question mark as to whether his style of play will help him stay healthy. And let's be honest, his reckless style of play has injured him the last 3 years. 3 years ago, it was the knee. Last year, it was the back. Or 2 years ago, it was the back, which might have been a result of the knee. And this past season, in the playoffs, after nine snaps, he scrambles on a blown-up screen pass, and yes, he gets cheap-shotted, but that ball should have been out of his hand a long time before he took his first step. So his style of play isn't going to change. You really do need a viable backup. The reason the Eagles lost that game is because Josh McCown, the 40-year-old backup who tore his hamstring in the middle of the game, was 0-for-3 in the red zone. They lost that game by 8 points at home. And the quarterback didn't produce. The quarterback they had as the backup didn't produce in the red zone when he should have. So having Joe Gibbs, the Hall of Fame Redskins coach, said the most important position on your team is quarterback, your starting quarterback. The second most important position is your backup quarterback.
Yeah, as we saw a few years ago with Nick Foles.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Of all towns, mm-hmm. The value of a backup quarterback, this town, which saw Nick Foles lead the team to the playoffs three times, he did it in 2013 as well, went to the Pro Bowl, was the MVP as the backup. He backed up Michael Vick that year. Then, of course, in 2017, he wins the Super Bowl. In 2018, he wins a playoff game. So, of all towns to question the value of a backup quarterback, this should not be that town.
We are speaking with Marcus Hayes, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Any misses in your opinion, Marcus? And I'm thinking here receiver CeeDee Lamb, who went to Dallas.
Well, I'm not sure you can consider him a miss, Mary, because unless you're willing to trade up in front of Dallas, which means you're giving up that second-round pick, then you're not going to get CeeDee Lamb, who I believe went 17th and the Eagles picked 21st. I will say this. I was a little surprised that they took Jalen Reagor for two reasons. He didn't have great quarterback help in college, but he had a lot of drops, number one. Number two, he gained 10 pounds in the month between his last game, a month and a half between his last game and the combine. Usually guys are getting in better shape at that point. And he ran kind of slow for a fast guy. He ran 4.47 seconds in the 40-yard dash. He lost 10 pounds in 2 weeks. And at his virtual pro day, he ran a 4.22, which would have been the fastest 40 time at the combine and one of the fastest. And it would have been the fastest in the electronically timed history of the combine. So he's a very fast receiver, and the Eagles loved him from the start. So I was surprised that they took him, but, you know, that's kind of what they do. They don't really let you know what they're doing. Not every year is a Carson Wentz year. In 2016, we all knew they were taking Carson. But as you go down the list for the Eagles, I mean, they got a fast linebacker in the third round and Devin Taylor. They've got a kind of a hybrid safety cornerback guy and Kevon Wallace in the fourth round. Good value picks. They got a developmental offensive lineman in Jack Driscoll in the fifth and another fast kick returner guy in John Hightower in the fifth. So they came away with a pretty solid draft. If I told you that these were the players they got in the first five rounds of the draft and didn't tell you where they went, I'm not sure that people would be as alarmed. People outside of Philadelphia don't see this as a big deal at all.
Yeah.
They really don't. The people who are sort of granular draft nerds don't see this as a big deal at all because they've lived through Brett Favre being drafted as a backup. They've lived through Aaron Rodgers being drafted as a backup and Jimmy Garoppolo being drafted as a backup. And, you know, Philip Rivers being drafted as a backup. So,
okay.
You know, it's really not that big a deal. But Carson Wentz is such a polarizing figure in Philadelphia, it's a big deal because of that.
Okay. Well, listen, one more question on this before we just have – I just want to head to the NBA for a split second before we leave. But how does this Eagles team post-draft measure with its rivals in the NFC East?
Well, they've got a huge advantage regardless of this draft because they're the only team that didn't change their head coach and undergo huge structural changes. So I believe Dallas had a very, very good draft. That said, you know, CeeDee Lamb topping it off. That said, I'm not sure how they're going to be able to integrate, you know, Mike McCarthy with their returning offensive coordinator and a sort of a revamped defense. They'll be a good team. They'll win at least 8 games, maybe 10. But the Eagles should easily win the division, especially with the Giants and the Redskins being in such flux.
Okay. Well, as the pandemic starts to play out, and in some areas of the country, there's the start of a reopening. You know, none of us knows really how this is going to go, but are there any indications from the NFL as to what it is going to do with the summer, with training camps, with preseason, with the regular season?
Well, everyone I've talked to is very pessimistic about the NFL doing anything before their normal July training camp opening, mainly because they issued a statement saying that no team will reconvene, no facilities will reopen for normal interaction until every team in every market can open, which is contrary to what we've learned the NBA is considering doing,
yeah,
allowing players to work out at facilities if your region is opening, if your region is being relaxed. And that could happen as soon as Friday. I'm not sure the NBA won't renege on that because there are lots of players who live in areas or are staying in areas that aren't going to reopen. And you might be seen as compelling players to leave their families and extended families during a pandemic to go work out at the facility or a facility to show their commitment to the league or whatever. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense for me on the NBA side. But with the NFL, you know, I would be surprised if we see a full season because I think they might have to start even later than they would hope. And I would be surprised if we see the resumption of either the NBA or the NHL because, again, we come back to this all the time. Until we have enough mass rapid testing, really no industry will be able to resume normal function, especially an industry like the, you know, professional sports world that is beyond non-essential.
So with the NBA and the NHL, which have been on pause for a while, the longer you go, the less likely there's something to save?
Absolutely. I mean, you can have playoffs in August, and you can finish the season out if you want in either sport. But it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to risk injury. I mean, these guys aren't skating. You know, the ice sheets are closed. These guys aren't playing basketball. And there's no way to replicate that, especially for older players. You know, and by older, I mean late 20s, early 30s. There's really no way to replicate that, to get back in, to be in basketball shape. We've been locked down for, you know, 6.5, 7 weeks. Most of these guys don't not touch a ball or don't not skate for more than 3 or 4 weeks at a time. This might be the longest layoff for some of these professional athletes, these winter athletes, you know, in their lives.
Does it seem likely that Major League Baseball will be able to pull something out of the hat to salvage the 2020 season? I mean, there was one idea floated, all 30 teams and players play in 11 ballparks within the Phoenix area. That was a little bit ago. And we don't have too much time, Marcus, but are you hearing anything there?
That's what I'm hearing. You know, if it happens, it'll be, you know, essentially two spring training leagues, one in Florida, one in Arizona. But again, you're talking about the necessity for mass rapid testing really every day. And until you and I can get tested as frequently as we need to, why should they should be able to get tested every single day?
Hmm. All right. One more question for you. Favorite moment of the 2020 draft? Was there one for you?
Yes, when Roger Goodell and Jerry Jeudy, Roger Goodell, who's a very awkward, you know, post-middle-aged white guy, did a TikTok with Jerry Jeudy, who's a very funky wide receiver, on national television, and it was awesome. You know, it was the kind of thing I think that our nation needed
It was fun.
It was fun, exactly.
Yeah, and that's
it was cool, and it was a relief.
Marcus Hayes, always great to have you with us. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Mary.
Marcus Hayes is sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Don't forget to join us on social media. Just head to whyy.org. Our engineer today has been Al Banks. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us, and be well.